This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, December 19th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellum. Support for KUAF comes from Northwest Arkansas Media, publishers of the Northwest Arkansas Times, Springdale and Rogers Morning News, Benton County Daily Record, and the Northwest Arkansas edition of the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. All offer local shopping opportunities through NWA Deal Piggy and Ozark Deal Piggy. Registration and more information available online at nwadealpiggy.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, with less than a week until Christmas, we get into the holiday spirit as the a cappella quartet 540 Express stops by for a performance. And if you're still looking for a Christmas present, perhaps you would be interested in a new children's edition of Pinocchio. We speak to a University of Arkansas professor who translated the story for a new illustrated book.
That and more, but first, last night, the Fort Smith City Board of Directors decided to place a four-month moratorium on new billboard advertising. Wally Bailey is the city's director of development. He says the decision for the moratorium started as a discussion with the city board about regulations regarding billboard signage in the extraterritorial jurisdictional limits of the city.
During that discussion, the board brought up issues that relate to signs throughout the city, such as, are we concerned about the number of billboards? Are we concerned about the brightness of the digital signs and other things? And so they asked us to kind of look into it, and we've been looking into it. They actually asked us to try to find something that would be very succinct and very simple in the way of a sign ordinance, and we've been looking and haven't been able to find anything. But in the meantime, we're pretty close to identifying all of the issues in our research that other cities address in their ordinances.
Bailey says while the city has been reviewing the billboard ordinance, several applications for new or updated signs have been submitted. He says the moratorium on accepting new applications was necessary so the city would complete its study regarding several issues associated with digital billboard signs.
We believe that before we have some signs located in some areas that we might find offensive to some of the residents of the community, that we think it would be important for the board to let us complete this work and then bring it back to them so that we would not have any signs located particularly too close to residential properties. At present time, we do not have a specific distance that any digital sign or any billboard sign can be from a single-family residence. And we think that we need something. And that's just one issue, but we think particularly that's an important enough of an issue that we need to be concerned about it and get that issue addressed.
Other issues with digital billboards the city is investigating include brightness, size, and the height of the signs. The moratorium on considering new billboard applications will last until April 19th.
Immediately after the November 6th election in Arkansas, news media reported that Republicans had won a majority of seats in the Arkansas legislature for the first time since Reconstruction. Arkansas history scholar Michael Dugan of Jonesboro gives context to that statement by describing the Republicans who ran the General Assembly immediately after the Civil War. He says the Republican legislators of yesteryear helped modernize the state when they pushed for creation of a college that eventually became known as the University of Arkansas.
They called it Arkansas Industrial University, trying to sell it a little better to the public that way. The Republicans created an education system. They tried to create model agencies of state services, and they invested in modernization. The symbol of modernization was the steam engine on wheels. In other words, the railroad. And if Arkansas was going to move into the 19th century, it had to have modern transportation. So who were the Republicans? They were modernizers.
Dugan says the Democratic lawmakers of the Reconstruction era opposed all the reforms which the progressive Republicans advocated. He believes the 2013 Arkansas GOP majority is largely the reverse image of the state's Reconstruction era Republicans, as many of the current day legislators have expressed opposition to tackling issues of health care, higher spending on education, and economic development.
So will the Republicans succeed once they're in office in having to actually assume the responsibility for doing things productively? Or will the Arkansas legislature become some sort of copy of the national legislature, that is to say Congress, where paralysis is the rule? And much of that paralysis is driven by ideological or moral issues on which there can be no compromise.
Dr. Michael Dugan has won awards for his books and articles on Arkansas history. In 2006, upon his retirement from ASU, the Arkansas Historical Association presented him with its Lifetime Achievement Award.
The Arkansas delegation in the U.S. Congress is speaking out again against proposed cuts to the Air Force budget. This morning, Senators Pryor and Bozeman and Congressman Crawford, Griffin, Womack, Ross, and Congressman-elect Cotton all issued a statement in response to the final conference report of the National Defense Authorization Act. That report indicates that the final bill would effectively retire older airframes such as the A-10 close air support and F-16 fighter aircraft. The move would effectively kill the A-10 flying mission of Fort Smith's 188th Fighter Wing, while A-10 squadrons would be retained in Michigan and Indiana. According to the statement, members of Arkansas's congressional delegation are, quote, disheartened by the United States Air Force's decision, which was based on the capstone principle of maintaining one flying mission per state rather than on a detailed analysis of cost efficiency. The bill is expected to go before the full Senate and House of Representatives for a final vote sometime this week before being sent to the president for his signature.
Construction continues on Vol Walker Hall, home to the Fay Jones School of Architecture at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. When architecture students and faculty return to the renovated hall next August, Jeff Shannon will continue as dean of the architecture school. The university announced this morning that Shannon, who has been dean of the school since 2000, has been reappointed to another five-year term as dean. The reappointment came after a five-year review of Shannon's performance. The review included input from faculty, staff, and students, as well as discussions with Shannon about his vision for the future of the Fay Jones School. Shannon was chosen as one of the 25 most admired educators of 2011 in the November-December 2010 issue of Design Intelligence, a bi-monthly report of the Design Futures Council.
Mostly cloudy tonight, 50% chance of rain, possibly thunderstorms, and lows around 32 in northwest Arkansas, lows in the upper 30s in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, 20% chance of snow with a high in the upper 30s, but a wind chill as low as 19 in northwest Arkansas. Partly cloudy tomorrow morning in the Arkansas River Valley, then clear and windy, gusts up to 35 miles per hour. Highs in the Arkansas River Valley, upper 40s. And for tomorrow night, clear with a low of 25 in northwest Arkansas, low of 27 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. Five area agencies distributing food this winter are receiving some help from students at Lingle Middle School in Rogers. The students and staff there donated thousands of non-perishable food items. They were collected throughout December at the school. This week, the agencies, including the First Baptist Church of Rogers Food Pantry, Arkansas Support Network, House of God Food Pantry, Grace Methodist Church Food Pantry, and the St. Vincent de Paul Food Pantry, have been picking up the food. Yesterday afternoon, I talked to the principal at Lingle Middle School, Mary Elmore, about the project that's titled Canning Hunger.
We have a group of students called WEB, Where Everyone Belongs, is what it stands for, but WEB students, and they are mentors to other students in the building. And so they kind of organized it along with our Fellowship of Christian Athletes group. The two sponsors work very closely together, so they organized it. What we did was we ran a contest with our homeroom classes, and the class that brought the greatest percentage of product won, and we just kind of did a small prize. It really wasn't for the prize, it was just a competition of it. And then, so we collected, I think
in the press release it had mentioned over 3,000 individual items.
I think so. It was amazing, actually. We've done it for the last, I think, 3 years, but this was by far the biggest year. You know, it kind of gets bigger every year, and this was an amazing year for it. And then we have local community centers that we donate to, because we know that we're, you know, our side of town is a high poverty area, so we want to make sure that, you know, the our families in our community and especially in our school zone are taken care of. And so we donate. We have about four different sites that we donate to every year, and they've been coming and picking them up. I think I might have one more group coming tomorrow so I don't have a lot left right now.
I'm thinking 3,000 individual non-perishable items, that's got to look like quite a bit. Where do you put them until...
We have a tree in our commons cafeteria. We have a big Christmas tree. And she would go around every homeroom and collect it so we could keep track of the numbers of items per homeroom. And then the kids did, and then they placed it under the Christmas tree. So the front of our cafeteria, if you will, there's a little alcove window. It was full of groceries until this week. And like I said, it's dwindling now because we've had people coming to pick them up. But it's amazing for kids to watch and see and be part of.
That must have just looked amazing a couple days ago before you started distributing them.
It did. We have amazing kids at Lingle, and the fact that they are that generous, in also given the fact that we do have a high poverty rate in our building already, the fact that they've been that giving and that generous just speaks volumes for our kids and our faculty.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Mary Elmore is the principal of Lingle Middle School in Rogers. Students and staff at the school collected more than 3,000 non-perishable food items for 5 local agencies to distribute as part of a program called Canning Hunger.
Last month, for the first time, the University of Arkansas Ballroom and Latin Dance Club took to the floors of the Ohio Star Ball, the largest ballroom dancing competition in the nation. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas spoke with members of the team, including one who won Best Newcomer International Waltz and Tango, and she has this report.
Ballroom dance dates back to the Renaissance period, has ties in the Victorian era, with modern ballroom rooted in the early 20th century. TV shows like So You Think You Can Dance and Dancing with the Stars have helped to revive ballroom in the 21st century. While it is the oldest sport at the University of Arkansas, the Ballroom and Latin Dance Club wasn't formed until 2009. This year, 2012, being the first time the club entered the U.S. National Collegiate Dance Competition. Laura Lynn Ramilly, a junior, is the president of the club. She started dancing when she was 17.
I started because my grandmother was a competitive dancer, and she got me into it, paid for my first dance lessons, and I fell in love with it right away. It's one of those things that doesn't matter who you are, it doesn't matter what you look like. You get out there and start dancing, and you work at it, and you realize that you've got some potential and can be good at it. And it's a huge ego boost. It makes you feel beautiful no matter what you look like, because you know how to get out there, you know how to move. And it's just one of those things that really stuck with me, and it changed my life a lot.
She enjoys it so much that she wants to pass it along to others. She's training to be a teacher and is already doing some teaching, like this social class where I met her. The competition team is limited to those that are advanced enough and willing to compete. This social class provides instruction and a taste for beginners, but it's also a chance for competition team members to learn something different. Competition dances are international dances, whereas the dances taught here are social dances, American-style dances that are good for going out dancing, a basic step that can be added to or mixed up for fun.
International is not really like that. You have set patterns that you learn, so it makes it a lot harder to start up with a new partner you've never danced with, like at a social dance. So you usually work with just your partner for international, not always, but usually. It's kind of different in the aspects of what you use it for. International is going to be more competition, and American is going to be more social.
Last month, 10 members of the competition team attended the Ohio Star Ball in Columbus, the biggest ballroom competition in the United States. Helping out with the social class is sophomore Sarah Ping. She and her partner were named newcomer international champions in both the waltz and the tango, though she just started dancing in January.
Yeah, I know. I was really excited and rather surprised, actually.
You had done other dance. Ballet,
I did
jazz.
Like every little girl does, and when they are little, I did ballet and a little bit of jazz. But I quit around 7th grade.
She says she liked the amount of dance that she got. It taught her how to move and some rhythm. But it wasn't too much that she got so strict about it. Inspired by movies, she always thought ballroom dancing was cool.
It's always kind of been on my bucket list to learn, and one of those things I've just always wanted to know how to do. And I heard about it my fall semester of my freshman year, but I was a little bit too nervous to go because I was worried that everyone would be super good and I just would have never have danced before. But
with encouragement from friends, she finally got the courage to go to the social class. Ballroom came surprisingly easy to her.
I was rather surprised at how easy it was, because when I watched some of the people who have been dancing in the competition team have been dancing for quite a long time, and they would do all these fancy moves, and I would just get there starstruck and worried that I will never be able to do that. But when they break it down and show you the basic moves, and it's just three steps or something, and I'm always like, oh, okay, this is really easy. So it's really easy if you know the mood of the dance, and if you know a basic beat and you can like basically dance and you know a rhythm, it's pretty easy to pick up.
The waltz, a category she won at competition, is her favorite. It goes like this.
Yeah, the 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. Yeah, just the one that they're spinning in circles and with the big dresses and everything. That's the one that I love the most.
A biology major, she's thinking about becoming a veterinarian and doesn't plan on competing professionally, but rather just do it socially for the rest of her life.
And since ballroom is more of something that you would associate with older people knowing foxtrot and all of that, and just watching some of them after they're like 60s and stuff and they know all these moves, I'm like, that's what I want to do. I want to be like the old couple that's knowing how to do it in the back, doing how to do foxtrot and all of that in the corner and everything. That was just something I'd always want to do, and just something fun to do.
Engineering major and fellow competition team member Ethan Glace also hopes to dance for fun for the rest of his life. His inspiration comes from watching a movie with his mother.
She just wanted me to learn. She didn't want me to be like the awkward guy or anything like that. I remember when Hitch came out and, you know, it has that really awkward dance scene. He's like, Ethan, I don't want you to be that. So my mom always wanted me to dance and didn't really latch on to it until I got into college.
He says dancing is a great stress reliever, and he likes knowing what he's doing at weddings. He also enjoys meeting people. He met his current girlfriend in the ballroom club. He danced with her at the competition in waltz, tango, and quickstep, making it past the first few rounds. One of just four guys on the team, he had to dance with other partners as well. As it isn't as popular with men, I asked him if he catches any grief from his non-dancing buddies.
It might not be the most manly thing in the world, but I have a blast with it. My brothers are always asking me to teach them whenever they do that. And, you know, even though my friends do give me a little bit of flack, whenever I'm out there on the dance floor, they're always like, he's like, way to go, dude.
As there were so few guys, Laurelyn Ramley had to dance lead for some of the dances of the competition. For this, she wore black slacks and a white shirt, like the men. But for many of her dances, she wore a green gown with black lace and black fringe. I asked how they pick out a dress for ballroom dances.
We actually didn't just pick them out. We had them made specifically for each of the girls. And what happened is me and our coach, Brandy, went through and we looked at designs that would flatter each body type and made sure the girls liked it. And the two of us went to the store and we started looking at fabric, and we picked fabric that fit personalities. It's got to be the right kind of material, so that kind of limited things too, but it took a while. But each of those dresses is tailored to the individual.
As you can hear, they dance to many different types of music. It was the same way at the competition. The collegiate dancers competed during the day, leaving the evenings to the professionals. The group was able to watch them perform. Laura Lynn's favorite couple was the World Latin Champion Duo.
It's incredible when you're watching the pros, because they're so good, you can't tell them apart. You can't tell who's better than the other ones. This one couple stood out from the rest of them, and so like at that level to stand out from all the other pros was incredible. They're really, really good, so it was probably my favorite to get to watch them.
Laura Lynn says that members of the U of A Ballroom and Dance Club's competition team are trying to go to a competition in St. Louis in the spring, but they will definitely be back at the Ohio Star Ball next fall. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Okay.
It is Wednesday, December 19th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Have you noticed we seem to be doing this mix of Christmassy and not?
Yes, but that's fair. Offer people
that's all right.
options.
So for the Scrooge among you, no. The Van Winkle Legacy is on exhibit at the Bentonville Public Library. It's an exhibit created by the Rogers Historical
right.
Museum, and it talks about Northwest Arkansas's first great entrepreneur. Hours today are 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and it is free. Tonight, back to the Christmas spirit. From 5:30 to 7 at First United Presbyterian Church in Fayetteville, there will be a celebration of light. It includes dinner and a life-size nativity.
Oh, okay.
Created by one of our favorite people, Leilani Law.
Oh, very cool.
You can find out more at 442-4411. And free flicks before 6 tonight at the Fayetteville Public Library, that'd be at 5:30 because it's before 6, is Elf.
Excellent.
Have fun.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Trout fishing in America, named after the Richard Brautigan novel, have recorded several discs aimed for children as well as adults. Before Being Indie Was Cool, the Prairie Grove-based duo has been issuing records on its own Trout label. Their 10th album, Infinity, was nominated for a Grammy in 2001. But 2004's Merry Fishes to All is the pair's first holiday-themed album. And now it's earned the duo its second Grammy nomination. Based out of Washington County, Trout Fishing in America, consisting of Ezra Idlett on guitar and vocal and Keith Grimwood on bass and vocal, have performances at the White House and the Today Show to their credit. The duo of Arky Transplants has grown its national reputation through several albums issued on its own label and 3 decades of near-constant touring.
After kind of having a struggle back in 1986 just to make ends meet, we decided we would take any kind of job that was offered, any kind of job. And we always loved playing for kids, but then there became jobs that we would play for kids.
Even Santa is expected to conform. Just because, Mrs. Claus, just because we really care. You've got to start the diet, or the man won't fit his suit. It's because Mr. Claus will not stop eating that we beg you. If he won't take care of himself, it's clearly up to you.
Trout Fishing in America recorded Merry Fishes to All in Nashville, Tennessee. Since it was April, they got into the Christmas spirit by decorating the recording studio with Santas and Christmas trees. The band was surprised to later look outside and see a freak spring snow had fallen. Taking it as a good omen, we knew we were doing something right, they said.
I thought Christmas Day would never come, but it's here at last. So Mom and Dad, the waiting's finally done. And you gotta get up, you gotta get up, you gotta get up. It's Christmas morning. Last night I heard reindeer on my roof. Well, you may think it's crazy, but I swear it is the truth. And you gotta get up, you gotta get up, you gotta get up. It's Christmas morning.
Whether playing goofy kids' songs or earnest ballads in the mold of Harry Chapin and Jim Croce, Trout Fishing in America exudes a wit and musicianship that comes across as effortless. Merry Fishes to All offers more, but in holiday wrapping.
In 1990, we put out our first CD, and we alternated years there for a while. We put out an album for adults 1 year, and the next year we do an album for kids. Next year, one for adults. Next year, one for kids.
And we've kind of blended it at this point. You know, it's just everybody, you know. It may end up in the kids' section, but it's for everybody. The music is really sophisticated, but not exclusive.
Did my sister get a baby doll? Did my brother get his bike? Did I get that red wagon, the kind that makes you fly? I hope there'll be peace on earth. I know there's goodwill towards men on account of that baby born in Bethlehem.
From Prairie Grove in Washington County, here's Trout Fishing in America from 2004's Merry Fishes to All, the group's first holiday album with I Got a Cheese Log.
At Christmas, stockings full of jelly beans, candy canes and a tambourine. I got a magic kit, a top hat and a wand. I got a baseball.
catches mint, an atomic watch that'll never quit. Hey man, what did you get?
I got a cheese log.
Mmm, tasty. I got a Lego set with a million blocks, a fuzzy robot and dog that barks. I got an automatic flag catching frog. I got a model plane with remote control, a kit for making donut holes. Hey man, how did it go?
I got a cheese log. I didn't ask for everything, and I've been good all year. Washed the dishes and I even fed the dog. Everybody I know got exactly what they wanted, but I got a stinky cheese log.
And a dozen slides, a skateboard, that's a blaster ride, a train set, a mountain, center town. I got a DVD and a VHS, some BBDs and a BMX.
And I don't even know what that is, but I got a cheese log.
Share your toys with all your friends, the happiness of Christmas Eve. Remember when it comes to cheese logs,
it's better to give than to receive.
Prairie Grove's Trout Fishing in America from 2004's Merry Fishes to All, its first holiday album with I Got a Cheese Log. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. Just in time for the holidays, there is a lavishly illustrated children's edition of Pinocchio just out. It's translated by Jeffrey Brock, who is a creative writing professor, poet, and translator at the University of Arkansas. He recently came by the KUAF studios to discuss the project with Ozarks at Large's Katie Hendrickson. She began that conversation by asking Jeff when he first came across the tale of Pinocchio.
That's a good question, and I'm not even sure I remember. I mean, it's the sort of figure that has been around all my life. I don't remember a time before I'd heard of Pinocchio, in part because of mainly because of the Disney movie, which was the first version of Pinocchio that I was ever aware of, and I think, like most people, I didn't know for a long time that was actually based on a novel by this Italian 19th century writer, and so it was much later when I figured that out.
Your edition what everyone's saying is it rescues Pinocchio from the Disneyfication of the tale. So what are the differences between the two?
Well, there's some pretty big differences, and I actually haven't seen the movie in many, many, many years, so I'm probably going to miss a lot of them, but one of the main differences is, in general, it's darker, sort of a darker tale. Pinocchio is less adorable and more naughtier, I guess, and it's more violent, and the sort of evocation of poverty is much, much bleaker. For example, the character. Oh, and the cricket, the talking cricket, is not called Jiminy Cricket in the book. It's called the Talking Cricket. So Disney was the one that gave him the name. The other big change that Disney made to the talking cricket is it let him survive, because in the book he's actually killed in the third chapter or something by Pinocchio. So that which gives you a sense of the violence of it. But of course he returns in the book as a ghost. It's a traumatic little moment in the beginning of the book.
You've translated this in an adult edition, and then this children's edition has come along later. What drew you to translating this work specifically?
Well, I've translated a number of books from Italian, and when my wife and I found out that we were going to have a kid, I started thinking more about children's literature, and it just occurred to me that I'd really like to be working on a children's book, and since I translate from Italian, the obvious children's classic is Pinocchio, and so I immediately started reading it again and decided I would love to translate it. It's such a fun book, and I knew it would be fun to work on, which it was. And so that's what gave me the idea, I guess, is the idea of actually making a version to read to my own kids, which I have now done.
And let's go back actually to the author, and he wrote under a pen name. Tell us a little bit about him as a person and his writing. Pinocchio was first published serially, and I was just curious about the history of that.
Yeah, sure. The author's name, his actual name was Carlo Lorenzini, and his pen name is Carlo Collodi, and he was a Tuscan writer in the mid-19th century. The mid-19th century in Italy was a time of sort of civil war when the country was being united, and Lorenzini fought in the war, and Italy didn't become an independent unified state until 1870, and he started writing this book about 10 years later, and he started publishing it serially, as you said, in the first Italian magazine of children's literature. And one of the children's literature itself was in some ways a fairly new concept, at least what we think of as children's literature. And the genre really boomed in the 19th century. And so he published it in serially in this magazine, and then it came out in 1883 as a novel. And so it's about 130 years old. And it wasn't translated into English for about almost another two decades, which is when its fame really started taking off internationally. And unfortunately, Lorenzini died before it actually became internationally famous. And so he had no idea what he had created, in a way.
And why? What is the universal appeal to the story of Pinocchio? Why has it remained so much a part of the cultural fabric?
I think partly because it's so fun and he's so mischievous and naughty, and it sort of has this didactic streak, but Pinocchio himself gets so caught up in his mischief, and his mischief is so entertaining that we sort of get I think readers sort of get to have their cake and eat it too. They get the moral lesson, but they also get to enjoy all the transgressions.
Umberto Eco has an intro, and he says, "The original Pinocchio remains as remarkable as if it had been written in the 21st century. So limpid and simple its prose, and so musical in its simplicity." I was just curious to hear your elaboration on that remark about this work.
Well, yeah, it's true. I mean, it's like I said, it's 130 years old, but it reads, it has a very contemporary sounding voice. It's just very plain spoken, and there's a real tone that still seems, in a way, modern, and that's part of what drew me to it. And it's aged well, I guess. It doesn't seem terribly dated the way some prose of that period seems.
When you were translating the work, what were the biggest challenges to taking the essence of what you saw in the Italian and making it something for English reading audiences?
Well, I think the biggest challenge is the tone, just because it's, and I think that's often the biggest challenge in a translation is the tone, and it's got to be, it sort of felt like it had to be just right. It's sort of this very colloquial sounding voice, and he's got he's from Tuscany. There are a number of Tuscanisms in the original, which give it a kind of a regional flavor in the original, which of course that the regional specificity doesn't come across, but the fact of this specific particular speaking voice is something I wanted to get across, that it sounds like somebody telling a story. And so it was just, I was just thinking about tone mostly.
And this is a lavishly illustrated version, and we're on the radio, so listeners can't look at those images. Why don't you go ahead and discuss this illustrator and what that brings to the tale of Pinocchio?
Yeah, these are wonderful illustrations in this new edition. New York Review Books published a non-illustrated edition about 4 years ago. and this one just came out with beautiful watercolors by this Italian artist named Fulvio Testa, who is really a wonderful artist. And he had been working on these illustrations for a while already when he contacted me sort of out of the blue, because he had seen the first edition of that contained my translation, and he wanted to pair that translation with his illustrations. So we just got in touch, and he sent me some of the illustrations, and I loved them, and so we were able to work it out with the publisher. They're just really vibrant, full page illustrations, and it's a fairly large format book, so you get a lot of detail, a lot of color.
There's a whole series of books that are put out by the New York Review. You want to talk about some of your other favorites that you like?
Yeah, they have a wonderful. The New York Review Books has a wonderful series of children's classics, and one of my favorites is The Magic Pudding by this Australian writer Norman Lindsay, which is a hilarious, bizarre adventure story. They've also got a couple of John Masefield books, The Box of Delights and The Midnight Folk, a bunch of other wonderful books, often books that are now sort of semi-forgotten or ripe for rediscovery, I think. And they're also sort of beautifully made with these, again, can't show it on the radio, but they're beautiful, often beautifully illustrated and beautifully produced hardback editions.
Jeffrey Brock is a creative writing professor, poet, and translator at the University of Arkansas. He spoke with Ozarks at Large's Katie Henriksen earlier this week about his new translation of Pinocchio. The book is now available.
On this week's Generic Blues Show, we have a great selection of Christmas blues tunes, a lot of them issued this year, as well as playing a tune that Jones and Leah did right here in the studio last week. Come join the fun Friday night at 9 o'clock. The Generic Blues Show. We'll see you then.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And recently we had a return visit from the acapella quartet 540 Express.
We did. Judd Burns, Jason Smith, Roger Hack, and Michael Baker Brown came back to the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
They had been here in the fall of 2011, mm-hmm. and at that time they'd only been together for a few months.
Right.
Now, we asked them to come back, and because of the season, they said they had some holiday tunes worked up. But what was interesting is almost every musician or group of musicians we have, we put inside the Furman Garner uh-huh. Performance Studio. And we did talk to them inside the studio.
We did.
But then
they wanted to sing out in our lobby.
Right. They love the arch ceiling. And they said, do we have to sing here? Can we go out in the lobby?
Which I was thrilled about, because I have told you that I think that the lobby is an excellent place to sing.
You have. Since mm-hmm. almost day one we've been in
yep.
here. So you felt vindicated.
Oh, I was so vindicated. I was very excited, though. Very excited. But before all of the singing, we did sit down and had a conversation.
Yes. And the first thing I asked them is, now that they've been together for over a year, what had changed since the last time they had come to visit us?
We know a lot more music.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think we're more comfortable in as an ensemble, but we're also, it's kind of funny, we're definitely better friends because of it.
Mm-hmm. The fact that we have grown so close together has helped the music to grow close together as well and become tighter and more cohesive.
Mm. Yeah, we hold each other more accountable, I would say, and it's easy to do.
Yeah, we're not afraid to say, you suck. Yeah.
so
didn't
more
sound
honesty.
Good. Yeah.
More honesty this year.
Yeah. A little more brutal.
Okay, fair enough.
Has there been, I'm sure then there's been a growth in the amount of, in the number of songs that you sing and perform and know?
Jason was saying earlier today, we have probably around an hour of, a solid hour of music that we can pull from at any given point in time.
Like for a set list.
Mm-hmm. And then even after that, we can add more and make for a longer concert.
Has the type of music that you guys have wanted to learn, has that changed during the past year?
Actually, it hasn't. It has expanded, thanks to Michael. He brought in a style that we hadn't been used to.
Yeah, I brought in some gospel. We started singing a little bit of gospel, and we've had a lot of fun with it. And it was just, we found a new side to us and have expanded our repertoire and the styles that we're singing, you know, just besides barbershop and contemporary choral.
What can be different about gospel besides perhaps the spirit behind the song? But take me through something that is different physically or mechanically for you in gospel than, say, barbershop or doo-wop.
To to me, gospel has much more of a natural flow, an ebb and flow to it. There are these crunchy harmonies that, in barbershop harmonies, they crunch together, but it's definitely chord by chord. It's much more chord based. With gospel, it's more line based. So you see how those chords work together to kind of fit a bigger picture of what the song is going to be. It's really, really cool.
Well, and I think gospel tends to be a little bit more in your body. You know, it's lower in your body.
You're more spiritual.
It's more spiritual.
You dance
and
a little more.
Yeah,
to it.
It's you know, whether you believe what you're singing or not, it's easier to sing because it tends to be lower and rounder, and you can pretty much use your full instrument in gospel where you can't in other forms, especially barbershop where tuning is a little bit more tight and technical.
Yeah, a lot more straight tones and instead of using vibrato and things like that.
Like how Jed was saying, chord to chord, you have to really nail each note in the previous chord to really meld into the next chord and make it really flow correctly and how it's meant to be sung.
I mean, I think, you know, barbershop is really fun, but you have to really get it for it to be fun. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And whereas gospel just
it's pretty fun from the get-go.
It's easy. You can make mistakes in gospel, and it's not it doesn't feel like a mistake.
Because they're not mistakes, is what
right.
It turns into.
Yeah, it ends up not being a mistake. It ends up being expression.
When you guys were here last year, you were talking about an upcoming performance. During the last year, you've had a couple more performances. Do you have a favorite?
Well, I think, honestly, the most recent one that we did, we actually got to travel out to New Mexico, out to Santa Fe, and actually work with some schools in Los Alamos, kind of clinic them on things that they're working on in their choirs and things like that. And then also we had a night performance where we had a concert, but what was great, we actually held a clinic that Saturday and worked with the kids and taught them two pieces, a barbershop piece and another piece. What was the other? Prayer of the Children. And they worked so hard. And, I mean, there was like 20 of these kids, I think, all the way from 6th grade all the way to high school, you know,
even
11th grade.
We had a couple of 10-year-olds.
Yeah, we did. We had
singing
a couple.
Five-part harmony. It was incredible.
Yeah. And
doing a great job.
Yeah. They could read music on top of that.
It was fantastic. And so we worked with them, and then they actually sang at the end of the concert. They sang the two pieces with us, and it was fantastic. We just had a great time. And the whole experience, I mean, us and the climate there, I was actually going through some stuff, you know, because of the climate here and all everything, you know, with allergies that's been going on. And got there, we were all nice and clear. And
yeah,
we really had just a good, fun concert. The whole day was just fantastic.
How did you get the connection to New Mexico that's so far from here?
It's actually a guy that he's a teacher as well as I am.
Mm-hmm. Jason Rutledge.
Yeah, Jason Rutledge. Mm-hmm. And we sang with him in Schola Cantorum, yeah, from the university.
In the time since we've talked to you last, the 14 months, have you tried anything that just didn't work?
Well, we have since scrapped Latin from our repertory list.
For now.
Not that we won't ever go back to it, but, you know, it seems that for the sets of our type that we do, it's a lot of crowd-pleasing songs. Latin tends to be a little bit more involved. The music tends to be a little bit tougher.
For the
audience and for us, the phrasing that you have to do in Latin, the vowel shaping has to be so spot on. And for that, probably we would do an entire Latin concert, an entire.
Well, it's also we tend to sing in environments that aren't necessarily concert environments. We go to the farmers markets.
Yeah.
We go into nursing homes. We go into
schools.
Public spaces and schools.
Mm-hmm.
And so we needed to have rep that was that was suited to those spaces.
Well, Latin kind of tends itself to be in rooms that have more reverb and sorts of things like that.
Yeah, one where you can, you know, sneak breaths and things like that.
Right. And they're not obvious.
Can't do that at farmers market in open space.
All right.
Okay, so now here we are in Furman Garner Performance Studio, which was built for musicians. You guys walked in and said, you know what? Let's go out to the lobby. Why our lobby?
It seems high ceilings are your friend. And this place has the ceilings are what, probably 14 feet high in the lobby.
I think we're going to walk out to and where you guys are going to stand by that microphone. I think
it's having an arch ceiling. It allows sound, especially from vocal instruments, to travel upwards and then come back down and provide a richer, more fuller sound. Basically, probably because of the overtone series. If your overtones are spot on, your vowels are locking in with the other voices around you, then it allows for more sound to be enhanced and evoked.
Well, and I also think, I mean, one of the things that we are not studio musicians. We're not used to putting on headsets and going into an isolation room. We utilize our space, and we adjust physically the way we sing to the space, and we're used to a larger space.
All right, we're not even going.
Oh, yeah, there are two parts to our instrument, and one being our physical voice, and the other part being our physical surroundings around us.
Right, and I was going to say that we're not even used to singing with microphones. Like, we usually just, like they're saying, use the space around us. So, you know, even using microphones is odd for us sometimes.
All right, well, let's see what the lobby sounds like.
Perfect.
Shall
let's
we?
Do it.
Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King, peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. Joyful all ye nations rise, join the triumph of the skies. With angelic hosts proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem. Hark, the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King.
Glory to God. And everywhere, go
tell it on the mountain that Jesus Christ is born. Now go tell it on the mountain, over the hills and everywhere. Go tell it on the mountain that Jesus Christ is born.
Jesus Christ our Savior is born.
Go tell it now on the mountain now. Go tell it now in the valley now. Go tell it now on the mountain now. Go tell it now everywhere now. Go tell it on the mountain.
Jed Burns, Jason Smith, Roger Hack, and Michael Baker Brown are the members of 540 Express. They recently stopped by the KUAF studios and performed in our lobby.
For many of us, the best part of the holidays is the chance to see old friends or to hear them. For several decades now, Paul Winter has made our holidays brighter with his winter consort and musical guests at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. I'm John Schaefer. Join us for the performance, Paul Winter's 32nd Winter Solstice Celebration from NPR Music.
The Winter Solstice Concert is Friday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. That could be the last day of the world, right?
That's what I hear.
Yeah, that's what everyone's joking about because of the Mayan calendar. There is an End of the World concert Friday night at Rogers Little Theater.
There is.
It includes Earl and Them, fronted by Earl Kate, mm-hmm. Candy Lee and the Sweets, and a couple of members of the Los Gonzo Band from Austin, Texas. Should be real good time.
Sounds like fun.
I have three pairs of tickets
that
will take you there. Now, here's the deal. Because I have the tickets, you're going to have to come to KUF and pick them up.
Right.
And the concert is Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm going to ask this question. You respond by email at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. And within, I'd say, 3 hours, I'll email you back around 4 this afternoon and tell you you've won. So that gives you tomorrow or Friday to come pick it up.
Yeah.
And then tonight, I'll give away one more.
Okay.
You know, we'll ask this question again on the 7 o'clock
sure.
edition. And so someone around 9 o'clock will get an email from me, and we'll work out the details.
Okay, sounds good.
You'll also, each of our three winners will also get a Tim Ernst calendar.
Right.
So 2 tickets to the End of the World concert.
So in case it's not the end of the world,
exactly.
you can plan for 2013.
That's right. You've got the in case it is and the in case it isn't.
There you go.
Okay, I mentioned that a couple of the members of the Los Gonzo Band will be on stage at the Rogers Little Theater.
Yes.
Los Gonzo Band, when they were together in the 70s as an entity, provided the theme for what PBS music program?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So
if,
we have to
if
know.
You're a fan of music or the Los Gonzo Band or PBS music programs, you should know.
All right, and people can have time to look this up in case they don't know.
That's correct.
Okay.
And they were based in Austin, Texas.
Okay, because I know I don't know.
Okay.
I would have to Google this.
OzarksAtLarge@gmail.com.
Fantastic.
We're going to give away 2 of the pairs of tickets this afternoon and 1 pair during the evening hours. I'll email you if you're the winner.
Support for KUAF comes from Heartwood Gallery, a local artists cooperative offering works in jewelry, pottery, photography, and 2 and 3D art. Open daily through the holidays with registration for a $100 gift certificate available in the gallery. Located at 428 South Government Street in Fayetteville, heartwoodgallery.org or 444-408-88 for more information.
Earl Kate will be on the show Friday, by the way.
You're very excited.
I'm very excited
yes,
about
you
that.
Yes, we're all very excited about that.
Talks a little bit about being on American Bandstand. That's fun.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah, with Aretha Franklin back in 76.
Wow, I look forward to hearing
yes.
about this.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. This is KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Van Buren.
Excellent. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Kyle will be back with his co-host, Christina Thomas, and Kyle and I will be back on Friday.
That's right. And for another brand-new edition on that potential, well, it's the first day of winter.
There we go. Have a good day.